Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, for someone practicing alternative medicine, my next guest has become a mainstream superstar. In 1999, Time magazine put Deepak Chopra on its list of the top 100 heroes and icons of the 20th century. It called him the poet prophet of alternative medicine. President Clinton has called him a pioneer. Mikhail Gorbachev called him one of the most lucid philosophers of our time. Maybe you don't put the Gorbachev blurb on your book jacket, but still. You can see him straddling media worlds and medical worlds, a regular on both Larry King Live and the Huffington Post, an internist, an endocrinologist, a one-time chief of staff at Boston Regional Medical Center, a critic of Western medicine that misses the root causes of things at the same time. Wonder what he thinks of the healthcare debate in Congress. We'll ask him. He came early to the conclusion that Michael Jackson could have been saved by proper medical treatment. He has publicly grieved for and studied with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he's written more than 50 books. His latest is Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul. And Mr. Chopra, thanks for coming on WNYC. Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, no sooner did I get ready to introduce you a name that I think I've heard a million times when an Indian American friend of mine wrote it and say, no, you say his name, Deepak.
Deepak, yes.
Say it right.
Yeah, Deepak.
Okay. And let me start in an unusual place. You wrote in Publishers Weekly this summer that the reason you write is to regain the mystery that got lost when you performed surgery on a cadaver in medical school. You said the sacredness of the body disappeared as the inner organs and tissues came to light. Would you mind talking about that? Why did that experience have such a profound effect on you? Why was it an assault on sacredness?
You know, when you go to medical school, at least when I went, I was only 17 years old, and my motivation for going to school was to understand the mystery of our existence. Where do we come from? What is this miracle that we call the human body? Where do thoughts come from? Feelings, emotions, memories, fantasies, dreams, desires, inspiration, insight, intuition, creativity. That's what makes us human, and that's what makes us sacred. And the first thing you are introduced to in medical school is a cadaver. And so suddenly, you're brought down to the banal, where you see the human body as a frozen anatomical structure fixed in space and time and put in preserved with formalin. So you're supposed to understand human life by examining a dead body. And I think that's where we get off to a wrong start. We stay with that model throughout our medical career, and we actually don't even consider that in our essential state, we are really consciousness. We are sentient beings. And so the mystery of consciousness is not something that we pay attention to. In fact, it's the only unsolved problem in science right now. Well, there are many problems, but this is one of the big mysteries in science. And very few people actually pay attention to what's the source of our consciousness. They just presume that it's the brain, but, the more we know about the brain, the less we know about consciousness.
But in your new book, you preach accepting the power of the non-physical world to maximize your physical health. I guess that's another way of saying the same thing. But for people who find that too mystical, what does that mean, accepting the non-physical world as a path to physical health?
Well, let me tell you how this book came about. Of course, I've always been interested in consciousness, but a few years ago I read some research on what is now well accepted. It's called neuronal plasticity, which means that you actually change the structure of your brain through mental activity that you can, including meditation, including, of course, solving problems. Every time you have mental activity, you cause structural changes in your brain. Synaptic networks start to link to each other, neuropeptides start to generate, and so on. So you literally, every time you have a thought, just like I'm speaking to you right now, I'm having thoughts, these are causing real shifts in my brain. So invisible impulses of intelligence, which we call thought, are causing physical changes in the brain. Now, it occurred to me when I was reading this research that you cannot have physical structural changes in the brain unless you're modulating the activity of your genes, because these physical changes are the laying down of proteins, and you cannot make proteins unless you modulate your genes, which for me was an astonishing realization. Later, I read research on the fact that your genes are not fixed, that, you know, your genes can be upregulated, downregulated, depending on, you know, your level of stress or your lifestyle or your diet, exercise, meditation, yoga, etc. So suddenly I realized that, you know, we probably are using the wrong terminology when we say the structure of the brain or the structure of the genes or the structure of the body. There isn't such a thing. The whole body is a process. It's a process, and it's a dynamic process. And, you know, when you look at this process at a very fundamental level, it's a process of energy and information. And we're not looking at the body as energy and information. Moreover, this energy and information is in your consciousness, which spiritual traditions call the soul. So it's complicated. But, you know, I'm now ready to explain it, and I'm excited because it's a breakthrough for me as well.
You write about meditation and speak about meditation. Can I ask you what kind of meditation you do? Because there are really many different kinds, right?
Well, I started off with transcendental meditation, which I still do. It's a mantra form of meditation. But I'm very much into mindful practices also. So whilst I take time to still my mind through mantra meditation in the morning and the evening, I have a meditative attitude throughout my day.
So mantra meditation is kind of allowing a defocus, and mindfulness meditation is trying to really super focus on one thing?
Well, mindful meditation is actually more witnessing awareness. So yeah, if you want to use that word, if you're witnessing just your breath or just your thoughts or just sensations in the body. It's called vipassana in Sanskrit. But what it is really, it is a disengagement from mental activity, because you shift from your mind to that consciousness, which is the witnessing awareness in which thoughts come and go. So ultimately, all meditation has the same purpose, to shift from mental activity to the quiet background consciousness, or what we call core consciousness, from where mental activity happens.
You do write about enlightenment in your work. Do you believe there is such a thing concretely as a state of enlightenment?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a shift in your internal reference point. So, you know, you can, your reference point can be your physical body, or it can be your environment, it can be your house, it can be your automobile, it can be your bank account, it can be your ego, but you can go a little bit beyond that, and you can find an identity which is deeper, which is your soul. And you can go even beyond that, and there's a state of consciousness called cosmic consciousness, where you can experience yourself both as local and non-local. In Christian doctrine, it's referred to as to be in the world and not of it. And then there are states of consciousness beyond that, divine consciousness, unity consciousness. And the more we have the subjective experience of these states of consciousness, the more we begin to realize that they have objective correlates. Your brain waves are different, your perception is different, your cognition is different, your behavior is different, and your biology is different. In other words, reality is different in different states of consciousness.
As a form of spiritual practice or a goal of spiritual practice, does this all risk becoming kind of solipsistic, in other words, too much navel-gazing about our own feelings and inner contentedness?
That's a criticism that frequently comes from people who don't know what this is, because, you see, solipsism is self-centeredness, more or less, whereas meditation takes you beyond the separate self. It takes you to a transpersonal domain, and ultimately enlightenment is a state where you don't actually believe in your personal identity at all, because you realize that your personal identity is a transient, impermanent, ephemeral manifestation of a more universal consciousness, and that's the only thing that it is. So but it's the very antithesis of solipsism.
But is that a feeling, or does it then tie to actions to end world hunger or bring justice
to
someone?
It has to be tied up to actions if it is authentic. You know, if it is not authentic, then you could probably say it's a contrived solipsistic kind of awareness. But if it's real, then it has to be tied in to what the Buddhists call loving kindness, compassion, joy at the success of others, equanimity, and love in action. Love without action is irrelevant, and action without love is meaningless.
Who is an enlightened being who you have known?
Well, that's, you know, I've known many enlightened beings who are not famous at all. Okay, in my travels in India, I've met lots of enlightened beings. I've met lots of enlightened beings even in Southeast Asia. Amongst the people who are public figures, I would say Thich Nhat Hanh from Vietnam.
Just spoke in New York last week.
Yeah, he's an amazing person. And, you know, to me, actually, His Holiness Dalai Lama has all the attributes of enlightenment. But, of course, you know, this is an internal experience, so who knows.
Is that the goal for you?
Yes, it's, for me, it's the only thing worth living for.
How close are you? How would you know if you got there?
Well, you know, how would you know if I was fooling you? You can't, you know, you should never ask a person there because, you know, you're trusting them and you shouldn't. I think the enlightenment speaks in other ways than my saying whether it is or not. It's what's the quality of my attention now? Where am I focused? It's all about me and mine. It's all about ambition or success or fame or fortune. Or is it now time for me in the autumn of my life to be of service? So those are the things that will be the signposts.
Deepak Chopra, my guest on WNYC, his newest book, Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul. He's doing an open center event at Riverside Church tonight, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you have an opinion as a physician and somebody who tries to look in alternative ways at health about the health care reform debate in Congress right now?
I do. I have, in fact, written extensively about it. I think the first thing is we're not talking about health care reform. We're talking about insurance reform. That's all they're talking about. Nobody's actually talking about real health care reform, which looks at what can we do to improve the health of our country. You know, and 80% of what is the expense of illness comes from preventive illness. The focus is not there. You know, the focus is not how can we reduce obesity, heart disease, diabetes, inflammatory disorders, which are all linked to lifestyle.
But can anything be done about those things at the policy level?
Of course, a huge educational campaign that looks at youngsters and children and healthcare policies and looks at also unnecessary procedures. You know, we do about 2.5 million unnecessary surgeries. The recent data on coronary artery bypass and also on angioplasty suggest that angioplasty does not prolong life in a single percent of patients who get it, and coronary artery bypass prolongs life in 2%. So if we just monitor the unnecessary surgeries, the unnecessary lab tests, which cost about $700 million a year, $700 billion a year, and we look at all the drugs that are of optional or marginal benefit, we'll have solved this problem in less than a month.
So would you recommend that Medicare defund reimbursement for angioplasties and bypass surgeries?
I think they have to be, Medicare should employ good doctors to monitor this. And, you know, this is the only industry. And first of all, it shouldn't be an industry, but this is the only industry that doesn't obey the laws of capitalism. You know, capitalism is based on supply and demand. We are the only profession where we as suppliers create our own demand. You know, you have an argument with your wife and you come to the emergency room with a minor chest pain, and before you know it, you've had an EKG, a stress test, an angiogram, and angioplasty, and God forbid, another 24-hour Holter monitor, and you're on all kinds of drugs.
Deepak Chopra, his newest book is Reinventing the Body, Resurrecting the Soul. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. One more reminder that tonight at 7, Mayor Bloomberg and Controller Bill Thompson meet in the first of two mayoral debates. WNYC is a sponsor, and I'll be one of the questioners, so you can hear it right here or watch it on New York One. Then I'll also be doing a live online chat at WNYC.org after the debate. Andrea Bernstein will join me for that, too. If you want to join that, that's at WNYC.org at 8 o'clock tonight. The debate is at 7. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.